So today's discussion objective, somewhat like the last time we met, are to provide some basic updates on how the COVID-19 situation is impacting the specialty pharmacy landscape. It's also to provide you with some actionable insights on operational changes that might be required for your operations. And then also today, we're going to provide a real-world experience dealing with COVID-19 on the front lines of a health system-owned specialty pharmacy. The intention is that this is a really casual sharing environment. Our insights are gathered from our guest speaker, our Shields experts, and partner health systems. And so we're going to be sharing those, and they're as up-to-date as we can possibly be. Effective yesterday, a $484 billion stimulus package was passed by the Senate, and it's expected to go forward. And it has about an $80 billion stimulus specifically for health systems. And then over 25 million individuals have filed for unemployment since March 15th. And this will lead to a tenuous outlook on the insurance coverage this summer. But in good news, specialty pharmacy has demonstrated significant resiliency to date. And so I'm sharing with you some information from our Shields Health Solutions partners, but I find it very interesting, and this trend has been reinforced from some other sites that we've looked at. So in general, our operating unit amongst our partner specialty pharmacies has been up significantly. In March, we saw a big bump of about 25%, and in April month to date, effective yesterday, it was up 10%. Our average day's supply dispense has been consistently up about 10%. And now when we met last time, we talked about that was one of the tactics that's being employed by many of the payers and many pharmacies to get patients those 60 and 90 day fills. Now our average right now is hovering around 33 days. So while we're seeing certainly those longer fills, we're not seeing it to the extent that I think many of us predicted back in early March. Total specialty appointments, though, in our health system partners continue to decline, and this is including telehealth visits. So in March, the total specialty appointments declined by about 15%, and this month to date, we're about 30% declination. That being said, the new patient starts haven't dropped so much. So now there's a theory that chronic patients are continuing to come in, but perhaps those new patients aren't coming in. New patient starts were down less than 1% in March. We have seen a drop in about 10% this month to date. So in general, our ability to convert those new patients hasn't been tremendously effective, and we certainly are seeing revenue continue to be strong, but this is where something to certainly watch. We do feel that specialty pharmacy is a bit of a unicorn in this crisis, though, as it has remained fairly stable. So in terms of the overall outlook of our specialty patients, some interesting things are emerging. So when we look at non-COVID-19 urgent and emergent patient volumes, there have been several studies in the cardiology field, mostly because it's an easy indicator to look up. The number of cardiology interventions in a study in Spain before and after the COVID-19 epidemic showed approximately a 40% drop in both PCI and STEMI. And a study that was released yesterday by Northwestern showed a very similar drop here in the United States. There have been some other studies and anecdotes demonstrating significant drops in non-COVID-19 urgent and emergent admissions, specifically in stroke and other things that we're used to seeing come through the ED. We're seeing fewer patients initiating on therapy in new key specialty therapeutic areas. And then medically administered therapies have seen drops from about 5 to 33% across brands compared to 2019. From an elective procedure perspective, so non-urgent and emergent, we are seeing that most health systems are exploring the path to reopening ASCs and elective procedures. But the revenue loss from elective volumes is expected to significantly impact our health system partners and their EBITDA at the end of the year. It is not expected that the volumes from COVID or really anything else that we can do at this point is going to change that dynamic for the end of the year. So again, what we want to maintain is patient care first. So our chronic and specialty patients require uninterrupted care, although there certainly seems to be a fear of coming into the clinic and the health system. So we do recommend proactive outreach and fills. And as we said, people are, many of the payers are behaving and allowing this to happen. So we are recommending that all of our partners and health systems across the country do reach out to their patients for early refills and if applicable, 60 to 90-day fills. Now, obviously, that doesn't make a lot of sense for some of our disease states that we work with, but for those patients where it does make sense, certainly something to consider. And again, across our partnership, we've seen about a 10% increase in days of therapy. Generally speaking, use that submission code of 13, although we have some very detailed information about payer rules and restrictions that we're happy to share with anyone on this call, just drop us a note. And make sure that you're contacting those providers for any prescriptions that are going to expire prior to June 1st. We've seen most providers are very flexible in extending refills, even if the patient is unable to come in. Now, clinical pharmacist outreach should continue to include lots of COVID-19 education. There is a lot of misinformation out there, and it seems to be getting stronger, especially with some of the outlash or controversy this week with people protesting some of the stay-at-home orders. It seems that a lot of misinformation continues to emerge. So YouTube is actually taking a tougher stance effective yesterday on some of these false claims videos, but the clinical pharmacist within the specialty pharmacy can certainly be a face of truth and continue to provide real-life information. You know, as you know, patients are more likely to be home and more likely to be interested in discussing their specialty prescriptions once you get them on the phone. The thing that we're seeing, again, is that this does impact some productivity. People aren't able to have those long conversations, or I'm sorry, they are able to have long conversations. You may be the only person that they're talking to today, and so they want to talk to you for a long time. Now, with them being home, we saw a lot of increase in patient availability in March, so people were really picking up the phone and available. We've noticed a slight decrease this month, and we think it's because there are so many telemarketers who are now taking advantage of the fact that patients are at home. So patients are just less likely to answer their phone as they go through. From a pharma side, drug efficacy, so I guess the first thing to note to all of the pharmacists in the group is do not inject Lysol. But also, unfortunately, what we found is many of the drug therapies, including remdesivir, explored to date, have demonstrated little to no efficacy in patient care outcomes. Obviously, that is to date. On the positive, although we all want something to work very soon, this will help alleviate some of the concern for patients chronically using medications such as hydroxychloroquine and tocilizumab. From a drug availability perspective, while there is some severe shortages being seen on the inpatient side, especially in the paralytics and in critical care medications, the specialty supply chain remains mostly uninterrupted. Many of the manufacturers, obviously manufacturer employees, are considered essential, and most of them have released statements, but they do not anticipate any shortages with the most popular specialty medications that we've seen. Now, in the pipeline, it's been pretty interesting to watch. So many new clinical trials that haven't yet started have been halted, especially in the neurology and gene therapy realms. And some in-progress trials have been suspended. Those that are continuing have allowed for some significant protocol deviations because they have to, because patients are at home. And so it will be really interesting to see what happens once we're getting to endpoints and, you know, how that's going to go with the FDA. Now, that being said, the FDA continues to be moving items along, and there are some new approvals, although we have seen some new launch products being delayed. So while they're getting approved, not necessarily being launched as expected. Trial results are going to continue, and virtual conferences are now the norm. And so we do expect, actually, in the next month, some very big conferences to be out there from a virtual perspective. But it is unclear what the long-term impact of some of these issues will be on the collective pipeline. Pharma is a very powerful entity in general. Likely they'll be able to make some modifications based on, you know, lobbying or governmental influence, but we're not quite sure how this is all going to play out. Then in HRSA. So HRSA has put out some statements in the last 2 weeks that have been much more clear than some previous statements being made. One of the biggest things that's been announced, was announced on April 10th, was that they are allowing some entities upon request to review to immediately enroll in 340B program. So it's our understanding that this requires specific outreach by the entity, and then you fill out a secondary form that justifies the request and why it's important for the health system to have this either child site or primary entity be covered immediately. And each Friday, the Medicaid exclusion file will be updated with those new entities that are going to be included. The other thing they've done is clarified some of the information associated with the health records, telehealth, and audits. So from a health record perspective, certainly, again, everyone is trying to manage, and there are a lot of things that are different than usual. There are some professionals, providers who are not necessarily always affiliated with the organizations doing work on behalf of patients. And certainly there's a lot of kind of medicine being practiced in the hallways in some of our organizations because they have to. So HRSA is taking a stance that this is going to happen and it is okay as long as you are truly trying to document and make sure that you have that information listed. Additionally, telehealth has been accepted as, you know, just another way to communicate with patients as long as it's within the clinics that are listed as child sites. And so the one thing that we want to make sure our partners and our health systems across the country understand is, you know, telehealth is probably going to become the norm, seemingly is accepted right now, and it certainly is falling under the HRSA guidance. But make sure that those telehealth visits align with your splitter and location file logic. It's complicated enough to keep track of the telehealth visits. We'll talk a little bit about that, but just make sure that you've got that set up. And finally, audits. So based on the current pandemic, HRSA is moving towards virtual audits remotely. And so, you know, we'll talk a little bit about accreditation visits being virtual. HRSA is taking the same stance and they'll be doing some virtual audits, which I'm sure will be a very interesting experience for those covered entities. Chris?
Thanks, Erin. I want to provide some operational updates that have come out since our last time we got together. So one of the updates is that the CDC has actually now released two guidelines for pharmacies. They updated their original one that was released about 2 weeks ago last week. And the updates that they made, it was about three of them. One of them was around masks, basically saying that everybody in the pharmacy should be wearing a mask regardless if they have symptoms or not, and that all pharmacists and techs should be wearing a face mask while in the pharmacy. They also recommended any kind of preventative services, really looking at vaccinations, should be postponed and should be rescheduled until after the pandemic is over. And then also, especially important for some of our friends out there who have pharmacies that are co-located within clinics, you know, right outside the oncology clinic or some of our higher volume clinics, is that making sure there's signs posted at the door of the clinic to make sure that anybody with symptoms returns to their vehicles and calls in, making sure that everybody who's coming in should be wearing face masks. And that you should have those at your facility to provide those to patients that are coming into the clinic. And then also, if depending on the geography and the structure of your site, making sure that there's a separate entrance for the clinic patients versus patients who are just there to use the pharmacy, and make sure there's some sort of barrier and that there's minimal cross-contamination, if you will, of people who are coming to clinic versus those who are coming to the pharmacy. Some other updates that we have in regards to workforce. So last time we talked about how all the testing sites were closed. Nobody could get a pharmacist or a tech license. That's actually changed where Pearson has opened up some testing sites for very limited number of hours that are only open for essential services, and pharmacy or pharmacists are included in those essential services. So those who are graduating or moving can sit for their MPJE or NAPLEX in the coming months. NABP has also started something called the NABP Passport, and there's about 18 or 20 states that are utilizing NABP to set up temporary licensures. So rather than having to email or call the state board of pharmacy and get a temporary license, you can do it through NABP, and that list is on the NABP website. And then the other thing for those of you who are involved in residents and residency training, there hasn't been an official statement from ASHP as far as any changes. Their current statement is that that COVID is not going to affect the residency year for 2019-2020 or shouldn't start the residency are any different for 2020 to 2021. Places shouldn't graduate residents early. There shouldn't really be any changes in any kind of requirements. And that's the last I saw from ASHP on that. Some other state-specific guidance. A lot more has come out in terms of ordering restrictions. And as Aaron mentioned, a lot of these drugs, even though proving not effective, there's a lot of states that have ordering restrictions. Some have issued guidance on compounding hand sanitizer, either saying to refer to the CDC or refer to USP. Some are allowing more therapeutic interchange in regards to combating shortages and allowing the pharmacist to do more interchange. And others are also redefining what they're allowing for telehealth and remote order verification, because that changes so frequently and there's a lot of them and there's a lot of differences and overlap. I'd refer anybody to the NASPA website, and which is continually updated with all of those different state-specific guidance from the state lawmakers.
Thanks, Chris. Regarding cold chain challenges, thankfully, most of our hospital and specialty pharmacies have not experienced any shortages in cold chain materials. There have been a few reports that some cold chain distributors requested letters to show that the cold chain materials were actually being purchased for essential services. Ultimately, that has not impacted pharmacies since we are an essential service. Some specialty pharmacies that previously had cooler take-back programs have discontinued them due to policy changes and also to ensure that they're minimizing the risk of infection due to this pandemic. There also have not been many reports of cold chain shortages, but even though that's the case, specialty pharmacies should still continue to monitor your existing supplies due to shipping from early fills, 90-day prescriptions, and the utilization of additional packaging supplies. In regards to clinic changes, we've had a few reports earlier in the pandemic where there was clinic volume drops between 10 to 50%. However, the increased utilization of telehealth by providers have significantly helped with the minimization of face-to-face appointments. As Aaron mentioned earlier, HRSA acknowledges on its COVID-19 website that telemedicine is merely a mode by which healthcare service is delivered. So hospitals should address in their PNPs how they're actually utilizing telehealth and how they're actually serving new or existing patients during the COVID-19 pandemic. Hospitals should also address how they're responsible for the care of those patients seen through those modalities for the 340B purposes. Hospitals should also make sure that their telemedicine visits meet the steps around access to the medical record and the relationship with the health professional providing that actual service. As a result of telehealth, there have been site-specific modifications that specialty pharmacy leaders have made to their clinic workflows. Some of the modifications include having limited staff on site to assist with those functions that are difficult to conduct remotely. Most of the clinic staff have been transitioned from the clinic to their homes. Teams that are working remotely have also noted that they've had several team conferences throughout the workday. As we're all struggling with this, employees have also had to learn how to work remotely and how to manage challenges such as limited childcare options, secure workspaces at home, and other distractions that routinely occur. In regards to accreditation updates, we do have a few that are listed specifically for URAC and ACHC. They have these following statements listed on their website. For URAC, through May 15, 2020, URAC will suspend all accreditation and certification of on-site activities. They will also transition scheduled validation reviews to virtual where possible. They will relax requirements for employment background screening and drug testing screening from prior to hire to completed within 60 days of the date of hire. They will also evaluate requests for the extension of application submission without penalty. And they will also evaluate the need to extend accreditation and certification expiration dates without penalty. ACHC, on the other hand, also lists on their website that they are temporarily changing certain accreditation policies and procedures in accordance with the latest directives from CMS. They have postponed surveys in states that were identified by the CDC as having more than 500 reported cases of COVID-19, as well as areas where residents were ordered to shelter in place by authorities. I will now turn it over to Amit to discuss his experience at NYU.
Thanks, Stephen. So I think a lot of the information that you guys just shared parallels our experience over at NYU almost to the T. As a quick background, so the NYU Langone Health System, we're located in New York. We have six inpatient locations and over 300 outpatient locations as well. And we are in the epicenter of this COVID-19 outbreak here in New York. And I think our patient or COVID positive patient headcounts have reflected that. Over the last month or so, I think the goal of our specialty pharmacy program has been to support our patients and providers in any way that we can. As a specialty pharmacy program that provides hands-on personalized care for our patients, I think we were actually in a good position to be able to offer our services to really help everyone get through this pandemic. And by that, I mean, you know, we are a decentralized program. We have about 35 liaisons embedded in the field. And we also have one dispensing pharmacy location. And in addition to that, we also have field-based clinical pharmacists that also support our patients. So looking at all the richness of resources that we have available to us, we've been able to, I think, extend our services beyond what we typically would be able to offer to really help close the gap and to help ensure that NYU could really help provide the full continuum of care for our patients. Understanding that our patients have been going through some, you know, very difficult times, I think for us, our primary responsibility was to ensure that access to specialty medications was one thing that our patients didn't have to worry about. So what we've done is, you know, working with our clinics and our liaisons, we are completing all the prior authorizations for all the specialty medications. In many instances, our clinics are short-staffed, so we are also providing prior authorizations for medications that typically wouldn't fall under the specialty bucket. And something as simple as that really goes a very long way in helping us to provide care for our patients, simply because lots of times you have nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants working on administrative paperwork, prior authorizations, when they could actually be practicing at the top of their license and providing clinical care. So by taking on those responsibilities, we've been able to increase the capacity of the work that our providers are able to offer to our patients. Additionally, we are also using our clinical pharmacists to check in with all of our patients. As mentioned earlier, as pharmacists, I think it's our responsibility to ensure we're part of the care team. And by maintaining communication with our patients, I think that they're also a little more reassured in that there is someone watching over them and their care isn't being neglected. And our clinical pharmacists are completely integrated. They have access to the EMR while going through routine assessments with the patients. If they're finding that any clinical concerns come up, they're able to really address that, triage, and act on it in real time by flagging something for the provider or really anyone else that needs to get involved, and really acting as a central point of contact in ensuring that patients are getting the care that they need. So what exactly is the impact that we've seen here at NYU? And we can probably go on for a while, but to keep things concise, we've kind of narrowed it down to a couple of bullet points. So prescription volume. As mentioned earlier, we have actually not seen any significant changes in prescription volume to date. In the month of March, we actually saw a spike in prescription fills through the pharmacy. And I think that was really helpful, because as patients are thinking through the next couple of months of their therapy, you know, they wanted to ensure that they had their medication on hand. So we did fill every prescription that we could. Additionally, we filled for 60 and 90 day supplies whenever possible. And a lot of this is due to the success that we've been seeing with telehealth. We've seen triple digit increases in telehealth visits, and that's been helpful in ensuring that, you know, our patients are able to adjust and alter their medication regimens and speak directly with their providers. And obviously the pharmacy is acting upon, you know, those visits. In terms of inventory, as mentioned earlier in the presentation, we haven't come across any significant drug shortage issues specifically within this specialty pharmacy universe. And our wholesalers have been doing a good job in terms of communicating any potential issues that they see downstream. For now, I think the most interesting thing that we found is most of the wholesalers now are allocating drug so that all their, you know, customers are able to access medications as needed. But aside from that, we haven't run into any major obstacles thus far. Another point that I wanted to make around inventory is about how the specialty pharmacy can further support the health system. And by that, I mean, we have a lot of different purchasing accounts as a specialty pharmacy. We obviously have our primary wholesaler accounts, but in addition to that, we have a number of direct contracts with more niche generic distributors, direct contracts with manufacturers, and deep relationships with pharma in general. And we've actually been able to leverage that to bring in non-specialty medications into the health system. When, you know, when the health system is trying to order medications, we have a lot of our typical accounts, but having these extra accounts just provides more options for us. And that's actually been very helpful, specifically with the NMBAs and other agents that are being studied for COVID-19. In terms of the operations of the pharmacy, I think most of the attendees on this call are practicing, you know, safe practices. So all of our team at this point is now wearing PPE when in the pharmacy. And I think that that's really important, both for the safety of your customers, but also we have to think about the safety of our team members within the specialty pharmacy. So at a minimum, all team members are wearing surgical masks when they're in the pharmacy. I think this helps protect our team from potential exposure. Other impacts on operations are things even as small as the patient signature requirements. We're aware that a lot of our patients are hypersensitive right now. Many of our patients are immunocompromised because of the medications we're actually providing them with. So there is some reluctancy to open the door to greet a courier or you know, whoever's delivering a medication and to sign for that. Fortunately, many of our PBMs we're finding are easing rules around signature requirements, and in place of the patient's signature, we're able to write COVID-19 on there. And in, if there was to be an audit, we'd be able to show that this was a patient who did receive their medication. We have the tracking information, and the only difference would be instead of the signature, it would say COVID-19. In regards to cold chain shipping, as mentioned earlier, what we had done previously is recycle our coolers, meaning we would take back coolers that were provided to patients in previous months. We'd clean them, sanitize them, and bring them back out for future deliveries. Understanding that that creates incremental risk, that's something that we've temporarily suspended. So, How can the specialty pharmacy program support your providers? And I think earlier I did mention some of those, right? So prior authorization is a great place to start, but there's other things that we can do as well, such as patient assistance programs. Right now, financial instability is a serious concern, almost as concerning as their physical health. So what we've been able to do is take a look at all the medications that our patients are on, and we're proactively enrolling them in patient assistance programs. And the amount of funding that we've been able to secure for our patients is very significant. And that's one less thing that our patients need to worry about. Last point is just around care coordination. Again, as a specialty pharmacy embedded within a health system, We're uniquely positioned. We have access to a lot of information, and we have the ability to provide remote services, whether it's MTM or just to check in on our high-risk patients to ensure that they're okay and to triage the concerns that they have. Finally, in regards to business development, going back to cost, a lot of our self-insured employers within New York City have recently been interested in, or maybe more interested, I would say is the proper verbiage, in figuring out ways to help cut their costs. And as a lot of these self-insured employers are seeing a lot of their expenses go up, they're looking to partners like NYU that might be able to come in and step up to the plate by not only providing medical services, but by also acting as a partner that can provide specialty pharmacy care. And we can work with them to create cost-effective strategies that can hopefully help them save money while also ensuring that their members receive best-in-class care, both in clinic and within the pharmacy. So for those of you who have your own health system-owned specialty pharmacies, this might be a good opportunity to take a look at the payers in your area, and if available or possible, to reach out to them to see whether they have any renewed interest in contracting with your hospital for care. So I think at a high level, that really summarizes, our experience to date. And, I'm sure that the landscape is going to be evolving over the next several months, possibly a year or longer. And I think the specialty pharmacy is in the position where we could hopefully evolve as the time changes and be something that our health systems, patients and providers can rely on to help improve the quality of care we can offer to our patients. Thank you.
Perfect. Well, I would like to thank our guest speaker, Amit, and our additional speakers, Aaron and Chris, for their insight today. As Aaron mentioned earlier, this webinar will be recorded and a transcript will be sent to all participants. Thanks and stay safe, everyone.